Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, and thank you so much for coming out tonight. It's such a beautiful day in Austin, hot and lovely, so it's good to see you. A few months ago, I hosted a panel with the neuroscience department at UT for Memory Matters with these wonderful researchers. And we talked a lot about memory and imagination and how we form memories and how we can create more nuanced memories in order to form better imaginations. So we had that conversation, and that night I was like, this is incredible, and your research is amazing. Can you please come to the Cactus Cafe and talk about it for Views and Brews? And they were game, thankfully. And although the events of last week are nothing new to this country, they are very timely. And so we're talking about memory and fear and trauma and perception and imagination in the shadow of all of that. So we're kind of keeping that in mind as we discuss this and how important it is to understand how our brains work, how they're interacting with information in this new media landscape, and how we can be aware of our perceptions and our actions, and so we can change behavior and imagine brighter futures. So that's in large part what we're going to be talking about tonight. Here with me to discuss memory and all of these wonderful things, from the Department of Neuroscience here at UT, we have Drs. Laura Colgan. Welcome. Also, Dr. Jared Lewis Peacock, welcome. Thank you for coming. And of course, Dr. Michael Drew. Thank you so much for coming. And all their work is a little bit different in neurogenesis and in sleep and memory and how our brains interact with computers. So please go online to the neuroscience department and check out their vast knowledge and research labs and all the cool stuff that's going on here at UT. But I want to start out by just talking about how memory works and how we form imagination through memory. What is that process? Maybe Jared, you can start us out.
Oh, you want me to start us out? All right. Hi, everybody. Hello. It's really bright up here. We can't see anybody. It's kind of fun. So how memory works? It's a very relevant question. It's a simple question to ask and a difficult one to answer. But it's one that we all care about or should care about if we don't think about this. So memory is a really hard thing to pin down in humans. So I come from a world of engineering, computer engineering, where humans design artificial machines that have quote-unquote memory, where they use silicon and transistors to store bits of information, and then you pile this up and you can store lots of bits of information, and you can build intelligent things out of that, and you can define pretty clearly what memory is in a computer. It doesn't work so easily or so logically in the human brain. Okay. So first off, where to begin is that it's useful to think about memory operating in two different systems or capacities. One is that there's automatic processing that our brain does that involves certain neural circuits, including some that are buried deep below our cortex. So that's the hippocampus. Many of you have probably heard of the hippocampus before. If not, it is a subcortical structure in our brain that's super important for memory. And what it is doing is that you can think of this kind of like a video recorder that's constantly recording our experiences. But it's doing it in a really crappy way. Okay? So it doesn't take perfect pictures or video of what we're doing. It often just extracts kind of the gist of what we're doing and packs it away. And that process is always going on. We're always soaking up information from our environment, whether we're conscious of it or not. Okay, and then so that's one key component of memory, is this system that is always looking for new things, that where the brain really cares about novelty, about stuff that is interesting or changing, for reasons that we can talk about later. But that's always going on. So stacking in these new memories of experiences that we have. And then we have this almost perhaps especially human ability of cognitive control. And that is our ability to to direct our attention and attend to certain things in our environment and choose what we're paying attention to in the external world, and also choose what we're paying attention to inside our heads. We can direct attention inward towards our memories. So that is a more controlled, deliberate process that we also refer to as memory. And this often takes the names of short-term memory or working memory. Our ability to focus on small bits of information for short periods of time to guide our immediate behavior. Okay, so there's that is sort of sitting on top of this automatic process that's always soaking up information. Okay, and so memory is really this dance, this coordinated interaction between those two things. Right, so I think that's the first thing that I wanted to lay the groundwork for.
And Michael, talk a little bit about why we remember certain things over other things. Like, what is it, and why do we pay attention to certain things and remember them when other things just kind of go by the wayside?
Oh boy, that's a good one. Yeah, that's all. Okay. Well, let me think about that. You know, I think one of the things that Jared touched on is that, we have this sense that when we have a memory of something, we have this indelible, very accurate portrayal of an experience or something that we learned. But like Jared also said, our memories are in a lot of ways pretty crappy, right? But for a good reason. Our minds are always... They have to be very stingy in, to some extent, in what we remember, because we're just inundated with massive amounts of information, and we have to be very selective about what we store for the long term. And so, as much as our minds are, or our hippocampus is a memory machine, our minds are also forgetting machines, and forgetting is just as important. And so, how do we decide what to remember? Well, if I could just riff on the first thing that comes to mind, I mean, I think. Emotional experiences are very, obviously this isn't the only thing, but emotional experiences are very important. And, everybody has the experience of a flashbulb memory, right? Everybody knows what a flashbulb memory is, or some people are shaking their hands. As far as I know, there's nobody in the audience, this is this, when something horrific happens, and maybe last week counts, toward that, 9/11 is the big one that people talk about. Certainly for me, we remember our flashbulb memory works in a particular way. My memory of 9/11, and every year when I teach this topic, I ask people what their flashbulb memories are, and my experience seems to be very representative. And my experience was that I was on my way to the lab, and I was living in New York City, and I. Was crossing the street, and some guy came up to me and said, "Do you know they just brought down the South Tower?" And this is New York, so you don't talk to people. And so I said, "All right, buddy, see you later." And I kept on my way. And then when I got to the lab, I turned on the news and learned what actually happened. And so what the flashbulb memory for me is not actually when I learned what happened, but it was actually my experience leading up to finding that out. And I think that reveals a critical part about memory, which is that the things that we have this sort of ongoing record, okay, and a lot of that stuff is forgotten unless something really salient happens to us, and that stamps in the memory. And we could talk about sort of the neuromodulatory systems like dopamine and norepinephrine and acetylcholine. There are all these neurotransmitters that are involved in stamping in those memories. But that's a key facet. And I'll stop there for now.
And so when things are really horrific, or when we're told, like, pay attention to this, this is going to be relevant to you as you move through the world. So things that we're really afraid of, or that could, like, threaten us, we are more likely to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in a very real way, those emotionally laden experiences stamp in memories and make us store them for the long term and be more likely to retrieve them in the future.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit. I know, Laura, you do a lot of work on sleep, so I definitely want to get there. But I want to talk about, how our our physical beings play a part in, I mean, as if our brains aren't physical. I know they are part of our physical beings, but like, you know, how our physical health and our sleep and all of these things play a role in what we remember as well.
Yeah, well, there's, sorry if that was a little loud. There are chemical balances in your brain. You know, there are chemicals that build up in your brain during wakefulness. And that tells your brain that it's time to go to sleep. Adenosine is a perfect example of one of those chemicals. And actually, for those of you who maybe enjoy to drink a coffee to wake yourself up, that is an adenosine antagonist. So it's kind of blocking that feeling of getting sleepy. But just using adenosine as an example, it gets co-released with chemicals that are released as your brain is more and more active. And it's sort of a signal to let your brain know, okay, it's time to rest. You know, we need to, rest and sort of get the resources back up and running again. And if you stay awake for prolonged periods of time, then you definitely are disrupting the chemical balance of your brain, and your resources won't be as able to function properly as they would if you were getting the right amount of sleep. That's just one example.
Yeah, we've all experienced that. Like, we're just kind of sleepwalking through the day, you know, but why is it that we think that we're awake and we think that we're making decisions that are rational, but sleep really affects the decisions that we're making, you know, without us being aware that they're affecting it, that it's affecting the decisions we're making?
Yeah, I mean, sleep, well, basically, these type of chemicals that are telling your brain to go to sleep are sort of the enemies of attentional, the kind of chemicals that will be allowing you to pay attention to things. So your ability, you know, as Michael and Jared both touched on, you need to be able to attend to something in order to store a memory of it. That attention is a huge determinant of why we remember what we remember. So if you're not able to pay attention properly, then you won't be able to remember things properly later. But also during sleep, there are thought to be processes, active processes that take place that consolidate your memories into long-term storage. And that's really important as well. So I always tell my students, don't stay up all night studying for the test, because while you may remember it the day of the exam, you're going to see that information again on the final exam. And by then you won't remember it because your brain won't have consolidated it into long-term storage unless you have a good night's sleep. You know, if you stay up all night, then your following night of sleep is going to be more involved in consolidating the events of that day, not the events of the previous day.
Fascinating. And you also brought up this great point, which is what you pay attention to, and which leads us to this current media landscape that we're in, which, you know, is a little bit different. There's a lot of things vying for our attention. Who would like to take that question? What is the brain on our current media landscape? What does that mean?
Oh, boy. That's kind of a dangerous one to weigh in on, I guess, but... The first thing that came to my mind, actually, is loss aversion, actually. And I find, especially in the political environment, right, the politicians are always weighing in on who's going to hurt you, what are you going to lose if you elect this other person, not what are you going to gain if you elect me, but what are you going to lose if you elect this other person, who's out to harm us. Not about gains. And one of the really fundamental things we know about how the mind works, how the brain works, is that losses are much more potent than gains are. There are very nice psychological studies showing this phenomenon. And so, I think the media landscape plays into that as well. I mean, what is always flashing across the screen? It's not good things that are happening, it's bad things that are happening, things that have the potential to harm us. very interesting studies by this Kahneman and Tversky showing a long time ago that they did these interesting studies where they'd bring you into the laboratory and they'd say, you know, how much would you be willing to pay for this pen? And you'd say, you know, you had play money that you could use, and you'd say, oh, that pen is, I'd pay $5 for that pen. And then there'd be another condition where you get to the lab, they'd give you the pen, and they'd say, the experimenter would say, I want to buy that pen for you. How much would I need to give you to buy it? And you would require a lot more, you'd want them to pay you a lot more money than you would have been willing to spend in order to buy it. And which is just illustrating this fact that we hate losing things much more than we like gaining things. And that, when I see the current media landscape, I'm always thinking back to that.
Right. So yeah, loss aversion is a really key psychological phenomenon that drives a lot of our decision making, whether we know it or not. What I was thinking about with regards to this question of the media landscape, it really dovetails nicely with what I study in my lab, which is multitasking, trying to do multiple things at the same time, something that we all do throughout the day. Some of us think we're pretty good at it, some of us think that we're not, but the reality is we all suck at it. right. And it's nice that Austin has recognized this with the no texting while driving law. I think that is saving, even though not everybody follows it, is reducing the amount that people do this, because distracted driving is a big problem. And it's a big problem because our brains are really bad at doing multiple things at the same time. Okay, it's really a good way to think about how our brain works and how memory works is that it's a fast serial processing engine that actually stores things in parallel. That's too much to digest at once. Let me try to break it down. So we're really good at focusing our attention on one thing really intently for brief periods of time. Okay, but then we tire out relatively quickly and we can't sustain our attention on one thing, and then we switch to the next. Okay? And the process of doing that switching, of focusing on one thing, and then switching to the next and focusing on the other, that the time in which we're switching is getting shorter and shorter. And part of that could be driven by environmental or contextual realities of our culture, where we're being bombarded with more information. The access to information is easier. There's just more channels of things to pay attention to that are driving us to make these decisions of switching faster and faster. And often when people believe they're multitasking, they think they're doing multiple things at once, sort of juggling balls, keeping multiple balls in the air. What they're really doing is switching very rapidly from one thing to the next. Well, it turns out that's actually a harmful thing to do for our memory and for our thoughts, that they're actually pretty fragile, precious things, these thoughts that we have in our head. And when we rapidly switch back and forth from one thing to the other, we are causing these thoughts and these memories to collide with each other. Okay? We're causing more interference. And this is one of the fundamental properties of that explains why we remember things and why we forget things, is interference. Is that if you have a bunch of related memories that are in your head, sometimes it can be difficult to pull out the exact memory we're looking for because there's a lot of other related memories that are vying for our attention, saying, you know, choose me, right? But it's not the right one. And that can explain why sometimes it's difficult to remember somebody's name. We know a lot of names, and names are just arbitrary labels that we attach to things. And sometimes the reason that we can't access some person's name is because there's a lot of other people that we've met that looks like this person that has other names that may not be this person's name. So memories are always interfering with each other, just in the background. This is happening during sleep. This is why consolidation, this is sort of reorganizing memories during sleep happens, because memories can interfere and can disrupt each other and displace each other. And sleep has a way of trying to smooth over the rough edges of things that we want to hold on to. And so by multitasking and also then paying attention to media bombarding us from many different ways, that is just injecting more noise and more interference among the things we're trying to store in our head. And that's having a detrimental effect on our attention span. And then research is coming out that's showing it's having a detrimental effect on our long-term memories as well.
And why is memory so important to how we understand ourselves and who we are? You know, what happens when our memories are completely wiped out and when we lose kind of the touch points of who we are, our culture, and all of how we know ourselves in the world? What are some of the devastating effects that you've seen?
Well, one of the reasons why memory is so important is because I think somebody has already touched on this a little bit. Our perceptions, all of us perceive the world slightly differently because our perceptions are filled in by the so-called top-down influences, which memory is one of them. It's basically like internal things within your own brain that affect the way that you take in information from the world around you. So the way that we perceive the world, oftentimes not all of the stimuli that are in the environment around you are making their way all the way to the hippocampus. Actually, maybe only part of it makes its way to the hippocampus. And then your memory fills in the rest of the gaps. So it's like we're actively constructing our own perceptions. So for that reason, it's really important to have memories, and also the way that your memories were formed, or the memories that you have stored based on your past experiences, actually very much shape the way that you see the world today. And that's true for everybody. So,
and Michael, you're nodding. You want to add something?
Well, my lab, one of the things we study is fear memory. And we study this in mice, and we use these laboratory preparations to study fear. And you know, to some extent, it's kind of academic, but there's real world evidence for why fear memory is so important. We study fear memory. It's very animals and humans, when we have a traumatic experience, we form these very strong memories of the experience. And when we're exposed to a similar situation in the future, it evokes fear. And there are, in rare cases, there are humans who lack the brain region that's mainly responsible for this memory, these types of memories, the amygdala. There's one very famous case, a patient called SM had some rare disease, and her amygdala bilaterally deteriorated. And what's sad, but really interesting about her case is that, you know, she had normal intelligence, normal person otherwise, but she completely lacked fear and the ability to form fear memories. And she also, possibly by chance, but probably not, had a high number of really dangerous experiences in her life. And so, for instance, she had been held up at gunpoint, I think, more than once, and she had been involved in more than one abusive relationships, and a couple other things like to that nature, which suggests that if you lack these fear memories, we all think it would be nice, and to some level, to be without fear. But lacking these fear memories is really dangerous in a very practical way.
So the only thing to fear is the loss of being able to fear.
Was that the quote? Something like that.
I think
like
that's
that.
The
yeah.
quote.
FDR I think needs revision.
I'm accurate about that.
Right.
Jared.
Right. So I really like what Laura said about the constructed nature of our perception and reality. And memory plays a huge part in that. Where the way that we perceive events and perceive the world is strongly biased by our past experiences in ways that we're aware of and in many ways that we're unaware of. One strong example of this has to do with language learning and speech perception in babies. So this is one of my favorite things that I learned when I was in graduate school studying this stuff, and is how do babies learn language? And there's this really interesting phenomenon and fact that I learned in that class, which was that when babies are born, all babies from all cultures can hear all sounds, can hear the distinction between any phonemes, any different sounds. Okay, but after about 6 months of age or so, after being exposed to their parents and mother and father talking to them and hearing language, babies lose the ability to distinguish sounds that have no meaning or relevance in their native language. You think of native Japanese speakers, we know many adult Japanese speakers cannot make hear the difference between the English phonemes of R and L, because those two sounds have no meaningful difference in the Japanese language. Well, initially when they were born, their brains could tell them apart, but they can't anymore, because the memory of the experiences of hearing sounds that made a difference, that helped them learn about their environment around them, they learn to ignore certain input, okay? And then that changed how their brains wired up. And that's a really strong example of it can be really hard to recover that ability once you lose that example in speech perception. Well, that is an analogy that scales up to a lot of other things in our life. The way that we interpret events is strongly biased and often restricted by how our brains were wired up through our past experiences. And sometimes it can be, and that leads to, that can be a very adaptive thing, right? That can help us very quickly assess situations and make sense of it and extract relevant and useful information so that we can act appropriately and act in adaptive and preservatory ways. But it cuts both ways. It can also then lead us to ignore certain information and make stereotyped, biased type responses, right? And so if our memories and if our experiences have led to our brains wiring a particular way such that it is biased to interpret a scene or an experience in a certain way, that can be a really difficult thing to overcome. Okay? Our brain produces really strong, prepotent, or almost automatic responses to things that have, those responses are fueled by memories that have been laid down, right? And so, I think that touches on some of the issues that you were raising before
Well, and also to add to that, in our last discussion during Memory Matters, you mentioned that it becomes more difficult as you age to tell the relevant information from other information that's vying for our attention. So what is that relationship then to the biases that we've created through our past experiences and our inability as we age to tell what information is relevant and what is not?
Are you asking me?
Yes,
you are. Right, so that is a pretty reliable fact of the relationship of aging and cognition, in that as we get older, it becomes more difficult for us to ignore irrelevant or distracting information. And we don't exactly know the causes of this. It could be that we just, our refrigerators are full and there's lots of stuff, competing, and there's less space to put stuff. And so it's we just have reduced capacities of storing memories. And it also could be that our attentional systems are degrading and our ability to identify and access memories that help us filter the world are degrading or going down, and we can't access those routines. And so it feels like we're getting bombarded with more and more information, and it becomes overwhelming. Right, what was your question? I feel like I'm just talking to myself here.
It was about the difficulty perceiving relevant information from other information as we age. So all of the information kind of becomes like the same thing. We don't know what's relevant and what's not. Yeah. But I think you answered that, actually.
So, oh, great.
Yeah, let cool. me. And so you're fine.
Nailed it.
And if it wasn't for the podcast, we would all forget that you ever even questioned that. So don't worry about it. In a minute, I do want to open things up for questions. But before we get there, on a hopeful note, maybe hopeful, I want to talk about two things with Laura and Michael. And one, Michael, is what you study a lot about, which is neurogenesis. And Laura, also one's ability to kind of change our brains and the way that they function. So can we talk a little bit about how we perceive the world, all of these things that we've been talking about all night about memory and behavior, and then how we can actually change our brains and what aids in that? So how can the brain generate new cells, and how can we change our perceptions and our memories?
Yeah, okay. So neurogenesis. Well, we started by talking about what is memory, and nobody brought up the topic of synaptic plasticity, right? So that's, you know, that's kind of important.
They were all thinking it. They were right? Like, what? Where's the synaptic plasticity? Why is nobody talking?
Yeah, well, you know, in many ways, we know very little about memory, but if you think about how neuroscience has really only been a science for 150 years, and 150 years ago, we didn't know what the brain was made out of. But what was that? Yeah, that's not that far off. It feels like that. But one of the first discoveries was that, you know, the brain is actually made up of these cells called neurons. And it's not just one contiguous lump of jello. It's actually independent cells that can communicate with each other across these little gaps called synapses. And for a long time, we've thought, mostly correctly, that memory is all about changing the strength of these synapses, right? That's synaptic plasticity. And that's probably, I was going to say 99% right. I don't know if these guys agree with me, but it's pretty right. The other thing that we thought since the beginning of neuroscience was that you're born with a certain number of these nerve cells or neurons, and then over the course of your life, you can kill them off, and we all do, but you can't get any new ones, at least if you're a mammal. If you're a frog, you're in good shape, but if you're a mammal, you can't gain any new ones. And then, so that dogma was overturned in the last 15 years, mainly. And it turns out that we do have the capacity to grow new nerve cells, but only in a couple different parts of our brain, and one of those happens to be the hippocampus, which is the memory machine, right? The best part of our brain is definitely the hippocampus. So not only are we growing new nerve cells in our hippocampus, it's really dynamically regulated, and so. This is most of what we know is from the animal studies, because it's very hard to study neurogenesis in humans, because we like our brains and we don't want to donate them before we die. but we know exercise, for instance, boosts neurogenesis, and stress, severe stress, suppresses neurogenesis. Learning new things can actually increase neurogenesis. Drugs, a lot of different drugs can mess with neurogenesis. One of the most well-known examples is antidepressant medications of all different types seems to stimulate neurogenesis. That's not saying that you necessarily want to take them just to stimulate neurogenesis, but anyway, neurogenesis is this really dynamic process that we have the capacity through our lifestyle choices really to manipulate. And there's still a lot to be studied about it, which is a plug for my own research funding. Anybody's out there, but
anyone.
But the evidence so far suggests that it really does help. It really does facilitate memory formation, and having neurogenesis to some extent is a good thing if you want to be able to learn stuff.
And Laura, your work is so fascinating as well, because you are figuring out like where we store certain memories and how those get stored, how long-term and short-term memories are stored, and then how we retrieve them. And a lot of it is about how we change. That's what got you into neuroscience, was one's ability to kind of change your mind. Talk a little bit about your research?
Yeah, so as Rebecca said, when I was a teenager, that's how I first became interested in becoming a neuroscientist and specifically wanting to work on learning and memory, because it was absolutely fascinating to me that through our own actions, we can change our brain physiology, our brain chemistry. That was just amazing to me. And the ability to, yeah, through your own free will, actually change your brain so that you'll be more likely to engage in different behaviors in the future. I just thought that that was so cool. And it's a very, I think it's a very hopeful way of thinking about things. And I still very much believe that. And that thread really underlies much of the research that I do today. But I think with that in mind, with some of the things that we talked about earlier, like certain memories can actually be detrimental to you, right? Like Michael talked about how fear is very helpful for us, but fear and anxiety can also be detrimental to us, which I'm sure that, you know, we've all personally experienced. And one thing that's really good to know in that regard is that every time that you retrieve or reactivate a memory, it's thought to make that memory vulnerable to being disrupted. And usually that's bad. Like Jared talked about, that can cause interference between different memories. But sometimes that can be good, because if you have a memory that can be detrimental to your well-being and, you know, a fearful or anxious memory, if you are able to reactivate that memory in a safe setting or reactivate it and think about it, you know, sort of work through it in a logical way, you know, you can work through things and change those things about yourself. And I think that's a really, really hopeful way to think about things. I'm constantly thinking about that myself. If I have patterns of behavior that I'm not particularly fond of, I really think about how can I change those so I don't engage in those patterns in the future.
Well, let's open things up for questions. If anyone has a question, just feel free to come right up front to the mic. Don't be scared. Won't bite. Just introduce yourself. Go right ahead. Yeah.
Hi. My name is Avine, and I was a neuroscience major back in college, and so this was really fascinating to me. And I was curious what you were just talking about, actually, about retrieval, and the idea that the more you access a memory, the more you make it vulnerable to being disrupted, and in particular about things like testimony and accounts given, and when people have to repeat their story for things like, you know, trials or police cases or things like that, if it's known, if there are any, I guess, studies being done about how, if we can really rely on testimonies and things like that, or if there are any hard kind of, if the picture is becoming more clear now about if
so,
that's even...
So I will direct you to the work of Elizabeth Loftus at the University of California at Irvine. She's done a lot of work on this exact topic. A lot of research showing that, no, many times eyewitness testimony is not reliable, and it's certainly not reliable if you reactivate a memory and then something is suggested at that same time, because people will honestly believe that that thing happened, that that event happened to them, when in fact it didn't. It just, you know, retrieval is a helpful thing for our brain because it makes us remember things more easily if we can associate those things with things that we already know, right? We always do that as mnemonic devices for remembering things, but that can work in a bad way. On the other hand, if you are recollecting something and then, you know, somebody suggests something to you at the same time, then, you know, later when you retrieve that memory, you'll put those two things together when in fact they didn't occur together. So that's something to always be aware of, and I feel comfortable going on record saying that.
Right. I think this hits on a really fundamental issue that I just want to reinforce, and it's the idea that anytime we access a memory, we make it modifiable. Okay. So not only are anytime we come up with a memory, are we constructing it, we're sort of piecing together missing parts, but we're also making it malleable and changeable, and it gets changed. And not only can it get changed, but things around it, similar related memories also can get changed as a result. There's a phenomenon called retrieval-induced forgetting. And that is when you retrieve one particular memory, that can have an effect of weakening, reducing the strength of related memories, so that it's harder to remember, say, other events that happened around the time of this accident, for instance. And so that's a real issue. And then also, what happens is another thing that we get really bad at as we get older is source memory, remembering where we acquired a particular memory. And that's what can feed into these false reports, is that often when we remember something, we think we're remembering the original memory and original experience that we're having. But often what we're doing is we're remembering an episode of telling and constructing that memory at some point in the past, right? So making a copy of a copy of a copy. And then at some point you lose the hold of where this memory came from. And then you can endorse something as having happened or not happened when really that's been far removed from the actual event.
The next question.
Thank you all for coming here. This is absolutely fascinating. And I have a million questions, but to give other people time, I will limit it to two, if that's okay. The first one has to do with what you just spoke about. I had something very traumatic happen to me when I was very young that I talk about, and I believe that it's to help me understand it. But it does make you wonder, if you have a long-term memory, how do you really trust what is true and what is not true? And my other question that I came up with here for originally had to do with short-term and long-term memory. Because, Jerry, you talked about the hippocampus being the source of long-term memory. But I have a question about when you have something into short-term memory, like you were speaking about, if you studied and then you stayed up all night, what is the process by which, and how do you select, or how does the brain select which memories in short-term memory get put into long-term memory? And how does that whole process work? So
great.
That's enough for me. Thank
great.
You.
Great. I'll give you your $5 after the show. That's exactly what my research program is about. Right. So the first question is a really good one. How do we trust any memories that we have that we come up? And I think the honest answer is that you can't. We don't have a way of really knowing what's veridical and what is stuff that we made up. It's really hard to tease that apart for ourselves, and it's really hard as scientists for us to tease that apart in you, right? We don't have good ways of measuring truth, subjective versus objective truth. And all the neuroimaging methods and techniques that we can deploy of recording and measuring and seeing what your brain is doing when you're thinking and trying to remember, all we can do is measure the subjective experience. We don't have access yet. There may be some neural signature that we can pick up on that can be, you know, the bullshit detector, all right? Or really say, this is true and this is not. He just is, you know, telling himself that he believes this is true. We have no way of measuring that. We may never have any way of measuring that. I'll just keep talking. The second question about differences between short-term memory and long-term memory, and how does stuff get from short-term memory and long-term memory, and who or what decides what gets in there. It's a very pertinent question. For many decades, people believed that these were two separate systems that had some handshaking game that they played, that there was dedicated areas in our brain, a lot of people believed in frontal cortex, that were these temporary buffers or scratch pad to hold on to information for working memory, right, for short-term memory. And then when we were done with it, it then got pushed off into our long-term memory stores. Well, we don't believe that that's the right way of thinking about things or how the brain works. We really believe now that short and long-term memory are just different descriptors for a basically unified system. Is that short-term memory arises by reactivating portions of long-term memory. It's that it's attention, it's our cognitive control, being able to select certain memories that are stored in synaptic connections, like Michael said. We believe that that's still mostly true, or what was the word you said? Most 99% true. That it can pull up these memories, and then by accessing these memories, We can strengthen them by reactivating them, but then we also kick in these other mechanisms that we've been talking about, is that by accessing memories, we then make them malleable, right? They can get interfered with if we get interrupted while we're retrieving some information, or we get distracted, we can actually interfere with a memory trace and make it harder to find later on. And so it's still somewhat mysterious, and there are many push and pull factors that determine whether something in short-term memory gets into long-term memory. Let me just say one final thing, is that an intuitive thought about this, and many scientists believe this for a while, is that the way things get from short-term memory to long-term memory is through rehearsal. Is that you think about something and you cycle it and you think about it over and over again, and then that's going to increase the likelihood that it makes it into long-term memory and you'll remember it later. Okay, we believe that that is false. And there's evidence from my lab and others that have shown that this process of rehearsing can actually induce more interference and reduce the availability of information. And so really, it's memory is less about rehearsal and it's more about association. It's about associating and binding information with other things that we know. So let me cut myself off.
Another question?
Hey, y'all. Thank you for the talk. I'm currently reading Arthur Koestler's Ghost in the Machine, and he's complaining in the 1960s about using rats and other lab animals as, you know, analogs for the human brain because we like our brains and we don't let psychologists and neurologists poke around in there while we're still alive. So my question is, in 2016, nearly 50 or 60 years later, how has the science come along? Is the science moving beyond using lab animals to discover what's going on inside the human brain?
Well, I mean, I think we're moving. Let me say first, there are a couple of reasons why lab animals are still really important, because the cellular level and circuit level of analysis can really only be done in animals, and in the past few years, actually, there've been such great strides in the techniques that allow us to analyze circuits in living animals. I mean, we're always trying to move to simpler and simpler species. So for instance, just to name, you know, one technique that's become really important on the scene recently, but there are many. I'll say two. I mean, one is the ability to do genetic manipulations, and so we want to understand the role of genes and gene expression and genetic differences in memory. And with the advent of modern molecular biology, we're able to manipulate that in animals. We can't obviously do that in humans. So great strides have come from that. And the other technique is something called optogenetics, which has become really important, and actually one of our colleagues was at the forefront of developing that, Boris Emmelman. And what that allows us to do is to manipulate individual neurons in behaving animals, even humans potentially, and either shut these cells off or make them fire at will. And we could do it with genetic cellular specificity. And even though that technique has only been around for less than 10 years, it's become incredibly important, and the knowledge advances have really been immense thanks to that. And that's something that right now basically requires animal studies.
Can I just mention one more thing about that? Is that the type of work that I do in my lab, it actually can't be, it's like recording from individual brain cells in deep-lying structures and looking at very fast operations that are involved in cognition can't be done in normal, healthy humans. However, there are human patients with epilepsy that have depth electrodes implanted for clinical purposes, and some of these people have been extremely generous to allow scientists to run experiments. And what we're finding is that the signals in these humans' brains are extremely similar to the signals that we see in our rats. And actually, my colleague and friend Josh Jacobs at Columbia, who does these type of studies, I actually asked him to send me a movie of some of his recordings because it's so amazing to me how similar they look. So I think there still is a lot that we can gain, as Michael said, from working with animals, but the type of things that we can do, we can't get at those levels of analysis in healthy human brains.
Also, there's a lot of work being done with worms and Alzheimer's, right? Because Alzheimer's is such a long-term illness, it's difficult to study it in humans, whereas in worms, it's a lot faster process. And that's here at UT. Anyway, and next.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to say thank you so much for coming. This has been incredibly just stimulating. I wish I could remember every single thing you just said.
You can listen to the podcast. There you go.
I love it. Always want to be on the podcast on the way out, too. And then you'll remember everything. Yeah.
So my question is actually about pseudoscience, or what I would have previously thought of as pseudoscience before I came to this lecture. But I have always thought about the effects of music or languages in babies and mothers, and you know, certain pop culture, pop science things saying, you know, listen to Beethoven around your baby and they will be smarter. But you were mentioning that certain things before that 6 month period are retained, and then afterwards you're not able to necessarily retain them. So native languages, listening to multiple languages at once in that beginning period, you're just nodding your heads. Answer's probably yes. What are the effects on multiple languages, and is that affecting an individual's ability to learn multiple languages?
Right. Yeah. Very, very good question. I think a lot of the pseudoscience stuff you talked about is pretty flimsy and is there to sell products of one kind or another. There's really not too much harm in it, other than perhaps eroding people's confidence in real and good science. But I didn't mean any jabs at anybody in particular there. The idea of early exposure to information and how it forms our brain development, and the way you phrase it, I just want to qualify it a little bit, is that so babies before 6 months aren't necessarily remembering phonemes or sounds in the language per se. It's that the processing of these words and sounds is changing how the neurons are wiring together. So it's actually changing their perception more than it is changing their memory. So they don't really have a memory in terms of being able to explicitly recall things till much later on. So exposing young babies to multiple languages, where language is one of these things where there's debates of whether there are so-called critical periods of brain development, that unless you you intervene at a certain time and teach language or teach multiple languages, that becomes much harder later on. That's a much debated thing, and a lot of critical period research has been debunked, and people don't believe it. But this but language acquisition is still one that has this pervasive finding of the phoneme discrimination. So, you know, I don't think we're at a point where we can make prescriptive claims of what you should be doing with your baby, or whether it's adaptive for them to be able to learn multiple languages. There's lots of research on, you guys I think are familiar with this, on the bilingualism advantage, that people believe that there's a certain cognitive advantage for folks that can speak multiple languages. But this is still an understudied thing, and it's an open question as to whether being able to remember more or perceive more is actually a good thing. And this gets back to your original point of you want to try to remember everything we said here, and I would say that would be awful. I would feel really bad for you if you went to a room for an hour, however long we've been here, and you would remember everything that is said, because you would then have so much interference. With, you know, if you recorded all your experiences, and there are people like this, Mary Lou Henner, is that some of you are familiar with this, right? That I have this perfect memory recall. They can remember what they had for breakfast in 1973 on Tuesday, June 3rd, right? And they are tormented by this. And this gets at an issue that we didn't talk about earlier that I was hoping maybe we would touch on a little bit. It's the adaptive nature of forgetting, is that what our brain is actually better at doing, and we're better served by our brain by it forgetting more than we are by it remembering.
Fascinating. Let's take two more questions, and then hopefully you can stick around after to ask a few more. Go ahead.
Uh-oh. I actually have two more questions. I'm sorry. I'm actually impressed by the turnout here today. I did imagine a lot of people would show up for a discussion of neuroscience. And my question is to the applications of our knowledge on synaptic plasticity, because I think not many students are going into neuroscience today because they feel like neuroscience is just academia and you sit in a lab with a lab coat and glasses and it's just terrible. But my question is, as far as amnesia goes, what is the neurochemical mechanism as to how we lose our memory due to amnesia as compared to, say, memory interference? And that, how does that influence our study on things like neurogenesis and how we can improve that? The next question is, you mentioned, as far as plasticity goes, a lot of things change as we grow older. For example, we now know that there are epigenetic factors that influence our DNA, not just the DNA itself. What are the external factors that influence our memory in our brain, and how do we protect ourselves from those factors? So,
Michael? Laura?
Yeah. So, well, in terms of the differences between amnesia and sort of the more naturalistic forms of forgetting, well, I mean, Alzheimer's disease is probably the best example of an amnesic disease, right? And I mean, that's where you have physical, ultimately you have physical deterioration in the hippocampus, is at least where it starts. And so, there you're talking about an actual cellular loss, and before that, synaptic dysfunction. And so that's very different from sort of the naturalistic types of forgetting that we all experience. Okay, there were a lot of questions there. What were some other ones? How can we protect ourselves against these things? I think we could debate about this all night, but I think there are two things that probably everybody agrees on. And one is that there's some evidence that by staying mentally active, we can strengthen our memory and build up a capacity to, even if our brain is deteriorating, we can have some cognitive reserve is the term, and be able to withstand that. And then the other thing is that, I mean, the brain is part of our body, and anything that's good for your body is also good for your brain. And neurogenesis is reflective of that. I mean, the things that it seems to be the case that the things that we do that are healthy for our body are also things that stimulate neurogenesis and keep it robust. And it turns out that neurogenesis actually does decline a lot with age, but it doesn't go completely away. And things like exercise, even in old age, keeping your stress levels manageable can not completely restore neurogenesis, but boost it up. And those things seem to be important for your memory.
Our friend, a question? No pressure.
Hello. So I like drugs. And you spoke about drugs and their effects on neurogenesis. And I'm specifically interested in psilocybin and MDMA. Let's say I was to do them both a couple times a year. Hypothetically.
Yeah,
let's
say
I did MDMA and psilocybin a couple times a year with no addiction. Do you think I'm doing a good thing or a bad thing?
With respect to neurogenesis, I wouldn't worry about it. So I'm not an expert on these drugs. However, one of the things I would say is that drugs like LSD and other hallucinogens are being explored now for their therapeutic potential. Something that, you know, back in the 1960s, this idea was batted about that, one of the therapies for treating depression and anxiety disorders have to do with bringing up those experiences and trying to reinterpret them, right? I mean, that's what we do in psychotherapy. And it seems to be the case that taking drugs like this may aid in that process. And so it's not always a bad thing.
However, on the flip side of that, No, one thing that I wanted to say there is that, these type of drugs that you mentioned, both of them are working on the serotonergic system. And a lot of things have to do with people's genetic predisposition for problems. So somebody could take ecstasy, MDMA, and be completely fine. There is evidence that MDMA actually is neurotoxic and that it selectively kills your neurons that produce serotonin. So if you're, as Michael mentioned, throughout just living our lives, there's other things that kill neurons as well. But if you're somebody with a genetic predisposition for depression, then you certainly don't want to in any way lower your serotonin levels. So I think, I would say depends on the person. And I think the thing that sometimes scares people with certain drugs is that you may not know what your reaction is going to be to it. So yeah. Not to scare people, but
so get genetic
not to ruin
testing.
Your fun. I don't want to be your party killer, but.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming out this evening. This has actually been really, really wonderful. And also, thank you all for coming out tonight. In a couple weeks, we're going to have another discussion on the new medical school here on the UT campus and what's going on there. So please come out for that. I believe it's the 26th of July. That's a Tuesday. At 6 o'clock, and check out this conversation again in the iTunes section. Just search for Views and Brews. Have a wonderful and safe evening, and thank you so much again for coming out.
You've been listening to a Views and Brews recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.